This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng. Bitcoin's price is now hovering between $6,000 to $7,000. It's half of the almost $12,000 price in the middle of this year and only one third of its all-time high of almost $20,000 that was achieved a few years ago. However, it has doubled from its recent low, and I was one of the person who didn't buy it at that low point, nor did I buy it when Bitcoin was worth less than $1 in its early days. And this reflects the extremely volatile nature of cryptocurrencies. Cryptocurrencies also has a reputation as the medium of choice for nefarious activities. Now, the SEC recently approved three new exchanges to allow people to trade cryptocurrencies like Bitcoins. Today on Breakfast Grill, we have Marcus Swanepoel, CEO and co-founder of Luno, which is one of the three approved digital exchanges. And you're already operating in Malaysia right now, Marcus.
Yes. Thanks for having me, Julian.
And so Luno, UK-based and having your business across 40 countries, 3 million customers, $8 billion in transactions, according to your website. Your launch in Malaysia, will this herald a new era of Bitcoin trading?
Yes, I think so. I think Bitcoin over the last few years has grown a lot. The cryptocurrency industry and blockchain more broadly has seen a lot of growth over the last 5 or 6 years. And I think it's an incredibly important opportunity for Malaysia that we are now able to do this in a fully regulated environment. Really the first time in most markets in Asia and outside of Europe and the US that one is able to do this. So I think it's a big opportunity, not just for Malaysia, but also for the world to see what can happen when you regulate things properly.
So just let's take a deeper dive into some of the details and looking at the pricing landscape for people who trade on such exchanges. Your fee is up to 1% for takers. Presumably the takers are price takers, right? And they're makers as well, who are presumably market makers. And there are various business models out there. You charge up to 1%. Some of your competitors, they are, like, for example, charging higher than you for a taker, but are giving rebates for the maker, so to speak. So can you shed some light on the range of business models that are here in Malaysia?
Yes, I think, look, just as a starting point, at the moment, we are the only fully regulated exchange. So if you are a Malaysian and you want to buy or sell crypto or trade it, Luno is, as of today, the only place to go to. There's not really alternatives. People can come up with all kinds of pricing models, but they're not legitimate businesses. We try to look at the market and listen to our customers to figure out what is the best for every market, right? So we will, that's our model today in Malaysia. But as the liquidity improves, as the volumes grow, we revisit the market and decide what is the best way to price it. So maybe over time that will change, but right now that seems to be the business model that works the best.
And what kind of volumes have you seen so far since that very short launch since November?
Yes, so we've only soft launched, and as of today we will be fully launched. So we've seen a couple of million ringgit already traded on that early soft volumes. But again, if you look back at 2017 when the market was growing very fast, you would see, you know, sometimes in a month, you know, a couple of hundred million ringgit traded. So the market is actually potentially very large, and we see that market building up to those levels again over the next few months and years.
So if we look at the volumes that are coming from the top exchanges in the world, for example, the biggest exchange is BitMEX, according to the website nomix.com. They have a volume of $1 trillion. Is that correct? That's a pretty huge number. And then the top 10 ranges from $30 billion to $500 billion in terms of trading. Now, Luno globally, according to this website, again, clocks about $700 million. So it's quite small by comparison. Do you think that this will... You can be big enough to reap pricing efficiencies. Some of these guys are charging in terms of basis points, right? One-tenth of 1%, like BitMEX is charging 2.5 bips for the maker.
Yeah.
And 7.5 bips for the taker.
So it's a good question. I think we have to take some of those values with a little bit of a grain of salt. If you look at BitMEX, for example, BitMEX offers a lot of leverage trading. So you can do up to, you know, 50, 100 times leverage. So that will inflate their volumes. And essentially what their product is to some extent, it's a gambling product if you, you know, want to use an extreme example. The way we've structured our product is just spot trading. We don't offer those leverage products to customers because we don't think right now that is the right thing to do in the market. And also within the regulatory framework, it's not something that we're allowed to do. So that's one thing. The other thing is a lot of those exchanges are global exchanges. So they will onboard customers from all over the world. So if you, you know, maybe they have an entity in Hong Kong or in Guernsey or somewhere and they can take global customers. How our volumes work is we only onboard local customers. So in Malaysia, we will only let local Malaysians trade against each other. We don't put all of the world into one kind of pool. And that will make it, obviously the number smaller within a market, especially if we're talking about, you know, currencies like ringgit that's maybe not as strong as US dollar. So that will always also make the pool smaller. But again, from a regulatory point of view, we believe that's the best way to do things. And it's also how the regulations have been shaped. And I think in the long run, that is a better business model.
So you have a tiered pricing structure ranging from 0.5% to 0.75% right up to 1%. Do you think this is too expensive? Because if you take the trajectory of the broking, the stock broking companies, right, they started with 1% long ago. And today we see Charles Schwab taking over TD Ameritrade and charging zero for broking. Do you think 1% is not too expensive?
I think it depends on how you look at it. So, you know, we have, when you trade directly on the exchange, there's a pricing mechanism there. We have also something called the broker, which is just a way to easily buy and sell, where you can just, you know, instead of having to put a trade on an order book, if it's for someone that doesn't understand trading, you can just click buy and it will set a price for you. Now, given some of the volatility in the market, we have to price that transaction to make sure that when you buy the crypto, that we don't give you something that puts us or the person out of pocket. So you will see some slightly fatter margins there. I think at the moment, the industry is still small. So remember, when we take these fees, we also need to run a business. And so we reinvest it all into the business. There's no, you know, people taking money out of the business or so on. So all of this, these fees that people pay are actually going into things like making sure that we license, building great customer experience, building our team and our customer support out. So I think where we are at the market, given the nascent stage of the market, I think the pricing ranges that we offer and most of the industry offers is fair for now. But to your point, as the industry grows and matures, will that pricing structure stay, you know, in place forever? Probably not. We will see as the volumes pick up, fees starting to squeeze as one starts achieving these, you know, economies of scale. But we're not at those levels of scale yet, like a Schwab or some of the other larger asset managers.
I think the government institutions across the world are also quite wary of Bitcoin's takeoff. And recently, Bank Negara and SC also came out to make some statements on Bitcoins and other cryptocurrencies along the lines that they are not legal tender, right?
So, yes.
But then again, SC has approved the setup of digital exchanges across Malaysia. It feels like this is kind of, if you can't beat them, join them and bring them into your fold to regulate them. So KYC becomes very important.
Yes.
And what do you feel about KYC? Because part of the appeal of Bitcoins is the anonymity, right? Mm. Do you think that it loses, KYC, renders Bitcoin to lose some of its appeal to many of these traders?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it depends on through which lens you look at Bitcoin, for example. So, you know, one would say, so first of all, I think there is a bit of a misconception where people say it is used because it's anonymous, because in fact, it's actually not anonymous. The better word would be pseudo-anonymous. So when you do a transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain, that transaction can actually be clearly followed. So it might not give your name and your address, but the transaction can be followed. So
it's still better than a KYC, right? A pseudonym is...
It's better.
It's more appealing to some, right?
It might not be me,
because I want to be legal in everything.
I know you're not you. I think it's important, you know, the lens that you look through it. So for example, where it does get a bit tricky is when you look at something like Bitcoin. Is it an asset? Is it a share or some, you know, commodity? Is it a payment method? Is it, do you use it for remittances or e-commerce? So because you can look at it through very different ways, I think that answer will depend on that. So for example, if you look at it as an asset, then that anonymity or the pseudo-anonymity might not actually be that relevant, because if you look at it as an alternative to gold, like, or gold 2.0, then it doesn't matter. If you want to start sending around, those things become more important. But I think there is just, you know, I don't think there's any scenario where the industry grows without people doing proper KYC and without being regulated. And it's important because we need to, at the end of the day, those things exist to protect consumers. And because it is a new asset class, because there is some risk involved, I think it's a very important start to the industry, and something that will persist. And really, regulators have, you know, been quite pragmatic about it. They, you know, like you say, they see that this is something new. It is potentially the future, and that's where Malaysia is one of the regulators that, you know, and the Securities Commission to take that first step and recognize this, just as we've seen with many other technologies, with the internet over the last 10 or 20 years.
So you don't think that KYC would actually place restrictions on the potential of the kind of trading that can take place on a particular exchange? And yeah. and would you like readily pass, for example, tax information to the authorities? Because earlier this year, a lot of your accounts were suspended because of some violations with the IRB, right? So right now, you're going to take extra steps to fulfill those kind of restrictions and taxation requirements as well.
So. Let's maybe just distinguish those two things separate. So the one, the KYC, does it restrict kind of adoption and so on? I would argue no, because a lot of the legitimate exchanges like us and a few of the larger ones in Europe and the US have been KYCing for 5 or 6 years. And what you tend to see is also a flight to quality, right? People want to leave their crypto with people that they can trust, that are regulated, or have very highly secure products like us, but we all also KYC. So we have seen the industry grow despite KYC. Now, you could make a hypothetical question, like, would it have grown more had there not been KYC? I don't know the answer to that, but it doesn't matter. It has grown tremendously. The thing that you raise about the tax, just to clarify there, that when we shut down some of our operations in Malaysia, it wasn't actually related to the tax. These things happen at the same time, but it was a coincidence. In many markets that we are in, we do engage with tax authorities, because similar to regulating the underlying instruments, it is something new. So tax authorities naturally want to ask, how does it work? Who should be paying tax? So we engage with them all over the world, and including in Malaysia. But one thing we have never done and won't do is pass any information of our customers onto tax authorities, right? And so just to be clear, they didn't ask us for the customer information and we did not provide the customer information. But do we engage with them broadly in terms of what would a taxation system for this look like? Yes, we do in all the countries that we operate in. And I think, again, it's important to build that legitimacy and that consumer protection and to give the government comfort that everything is working above board.
Today on The Breakfast Grill, we have Marcus Swanepoel, CEO and co-founder of Luno, one of the only operating exchange at the moment of digital assets in Malaysia. We're talking about bitcoins and cryptocurrency. We'll be back with more conversation after this. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning is Marcus Swanepoel, CEO and co-founder of Luno, which is one of the companies that are operating a digital exchange in Malaysia, digital asset exchange. And Marcus, I just want to turn attention to macro factors a little bit. And we saw recently that Facebook tried to launch the Libra coin to destroy high payments in transaction costs around the world. But governments across the world, particularly US and Europe, were kind of insecure about Facebook's Libra coin because it has the ability to disrupt monetary policy, to hijack monetary policy if you're more pessimistic about it. And Facebook is very powerful. I mean, it's an economy of 2.5 billion people. So they are in a position to actually make it happen. What are your views on this, on the Libra coin and on the possibility of disruption of monetary policy through cryptocurrency?
It's a very good question. I think, you know, we just as a general point, I think it's, you know, anything that is going to help consumers bring transaction costs down, make things more secure, make things more transparent when it comes to money, those are things we support. So I think if you look at what Facebook's trying to do, at a very macro level, these are the things that they're thinking about. Whether they intended for that to be disruptive to, you know, monetary policy for a government, I'm not entirely sure if that was the intention. I think it was maybe a bit more altruistic than that. But we are now sitting in a reality where governments are looking at it at, you know, and through that lens and say, like you said, the pessimistic view might be, wow, this might be a problem. And I think for that reason, we've seen Facebook, you know, be very clear that they are going to work with governments to ensure that anything that they do will be regulated and that they will work with governments to make sure that they do it in a way that works. So that is certainly a view that we also support. So I think the takeaway for me out of the whole Facebook Libra thing is more the idea that, you know, companies are starting to think big like that. It is accelerating regulators and governments to really take cryptocurrency seriously and say, look, maybe today it's Facebook, maybe later it's Tencent or, you know, another company that's going to try something similar. So we need to get our heads around it. And I suspect where we're going to end up is something where governments either regulate it in a very strong way or governments themselves become players in this space. So, you know, there's a lot of governments that talk about central bank issued stable coins and so on. So I think...
But that's just, you know, digitalizing the existing monetary system, right?
Exactly.
If the government issues stable coins. But, you know, the original intentions of Satoshi Nakamoto, the founder of Bitcoin, whoever he is, he talks about decentralization and he talks about independence and devolution from the control of governments. And though there is also a question of whether governments can keep up with this technology because these are such complex technologies.
Yes.
Anybody can come up with an idea and it feels that users of cryptos want independence. It feels that technology wants to go that direction. You know, P2P, you're not a P2P exchange, but a P2P exchange is just basically an exchange between two individuals.
It's a very good point. And I think we have to be quite pragmatic how we think about this industry evolving. You know, you could say Satoshi and Bitcoin had certain kind of objectives in mind. But we also have to face the reality of the world we live in that there are governments, regulation is needed. And so I think we will find a golden path.
My question is whether the government can actually keep up with that. You know, of course it's needed to protect everybody, but can governments actually keep up with something that people just decided to do out of their own whims?
No, and it's a very good question. I think if governments move fast, the answer would be yes. In some cases where the governments move too slow, which is often the case, it might take too long or be too late. And so I don't know the answer to that question, but it's like you said, there's almost this undercurrent or an inertia of people wanting to be more in control of not just their money, but everything tech, and having, you know, being able to do things a lot faster, basically free and so on. So when you see a technological kind of shift like that, it is sometimes very difficult to stop these things. But again, we don't know where it's going to end up. I'll give you an example of, you know, how it could be the best of both worlds. So we could live in a world where people use, you know, cryptocurrency directly, like everyone uses Bitcoin or Libra or maybe some other types of stable coins. But there's another argument to say maybe we live in a world where people use government-issued currencies, but when you move those currencies into other currencies, it goes through some neutral currency. So, for example, when you say send ringgit to rupiah, it switches through Bitcoin or it switches through Libra in the background. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that often it switches through US dollar. So to have a new global neutral currency that is almost underpinning the global financial system is an interesting concept, and it's potentially not threatening to the fiat currency model for government. So again, I don't know which of those two outcomes we're going to deal with, but they are both potential outcomes.
So I think that's very interesting too, the argument of what exactly is the valuation of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoins, Ethereums, and so on, because people have argued that they're not necessarily money, they don't have that kind of valuation. And a lot of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoins are used for speculation. How would you approach some kind of a fundamental valuation for cryptocurrencies?
It's a very good question. And I think when we try and teach people about cryptocurrency, we often find you almost have to go back and ask fundamental questions about the money people use today. So, for example, a lot of our users, when we ask them, you know, when you look at your ringgit balance, what does that actually, what does it mean? Where, you know, what is that? Who's behind that? And the question we would often get is people think that it's gold in a vault. And the reality is it's not been like that for generations. It's just numbers that are made up. And so I think when people start to understand that, then it becomes a little bit easier to say, okay, but hold on, now let me think about you know, Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, where does that value come from?
But paper or fiat currency is arguably based on the value of the economy, right? What is Bitcoin based on?
So the, again, there's two lenses we can look through it. The one is, if you think of it as an asset, it's modeled similar to gold. So it has limited supply and has many of the characteristics that gold has, and that in itself gives it value. But the other way to look at it is, if we think, and which we believe eventually it will be some form of payment system for e-commerce, for remittances, all kinds of money transfer, then you can think of the value of Bitcoin as a payment system. So you can always think about it as buying shares. If you buy Bitcoin, it's like buying shares in Visa. Then you go to the 7-Eleven, you say, can I buy a Coke? And then the person says, sure, I will take Ringgit or I will take Visa shares. Okay, sure, I'll pay with the Visa shares. So the underlying value is a global payment system, and that gives it value in addition to the, you know, the asset valuation. So somewhere in between the asset and the global payment system, the fundamental value sits.
So earlier on in Bitcoin's day, some people have predicted that it would hit about $1 million per coin. I think we are a far cry from those kinds of valuation. But do you have an outlook of in 2020, what would Bitcoin be? Or in fact, in the longer term, what is your price target for Bitcoin?
Or even Ethereum? Yeah, so I mean, one thing we most certainly don't do is give any financial advice or predictions around the cryptocurrency market. All we do know is that it is a new technology that, you know, over the last 10 years has grown in value. It keeps on coming in waves. You know, every cycle of, you know, 10 to 18 months, you will see over time that increasing. So all we know is qualitatively, if you look at the history, one can determine that probably as it becomes more popular and it gets used more, it will go bigger. What that number is it a million? Is it half a million? Is it 10 million? That unfortunately,
but,
I don't know.
You know, from a conceptual viewpoint, you probably have an interest to see that Bitcoin is an asset that's rising in price, right? Because earlier on you mentioned that this can be part of the portfolio. But Bitcoin is so volatile. The pricing is so volatile. I mean, 10 bucks at one moment, 10,000 at one moment, and now it's like 6,000 to 7,000.
Yeah. And I think that's why you have to take a long-term view with this. If you, you know,
You think the long-term trajectory would be a rising trajectory?
Yes, if you look at it, if you take the price now and you look back every 2 years over the last 10 years, if you look at it on a 2 or 3 year cycle, it's always gone up a lot. If you compare it to 3 weeks ago, 6 months ago, no, who knows, right? And I think, you know, it's, you know, Bitcoin is a very good reflection of this flaw that we as humans have where our memory is very short, right? And if I walk into the studio this morning, the price went down by 10%, everyone will say, oh, the price has gone down again. But if we say, oh, what was it like 2 years ago? It's maybe up by like 170%. So it's just how we, you know, what time frames we use. And I think that's important for people to realize it is a long-term asset. It's not something to really think that you're going to make a quick buck.
Now, you were quoted as saying that Luno wants to help upgrade the world to a better financial system. Do you think that Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies will ever become legal tender?
As I mentioned, whether it will become legal tender, there is a question mark. One outcome might be that it just is a support to the existing legal tender and it all happens in the background. Maybe something will become legal tender. But we do think one way or another, it is going to help make the whole financial system more efficient. And at the end of the day, all of that value that is currently being extracted by a lot of kind of players all over the world, you know, whether they're payment companies or banks or maybe even governments, all of that value eventually will accrue to consumers. So that is why we're investing so much time into education, into regulation, so that ultimately consumers can benefit from this.
Thank you so much for joining us. And that was Marcus Swanepoel, CEO and co-founder of Luno, talking to us today about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, as well as digital asset exchanges. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.